One of the many points of contention in the current campaign for president is war and how either of the candidates would wage war or avoid waging it as president. Our guests this hour take us back to previous presidencies to consider how occupants of the White House approached war. In general, our guests find presidents went to war for selfish reasons, even the ones we think of as great and noble warriors like Abraham Lincoln. The findings are contained in the book The Spoils of War, Greed, Power, and the Conflicts That Made Our Greatest Presidents. The authors are Bruce Bueno de Mesquita and Alistair Smith. Bruce Bueno de Mesquita is Julia Silver Professor of Politics at New York University, as is, and then Alistair Smith is also Professor of Politics as well at NYU. Bruce has written 20 books, including one with Alistair, and they visited several years ago to talk about that earlier book, The Dictator's Handbook, and remember it well. Bruce Bueno de Mesquita, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Alistair Smith, good to hear from you again.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, gentlemen, you can decide who gets to answer which question. We just sort of ping-pong it around. When you say that presidents waged war for selfish reasons, do you mean political or money or all the above?
Well, some of each. In George Washington's case, his decision to wage the American Revolution was to a large extent driven by his land speculation, which was vast. I think very few people realize how wealthy a man George Washington was and how much of that wealth was at risk because of the policies of the king. There is an economics reckoning that says that in today's dollars, adjusted for inflation, George Washington would have been worth $20 billion with a B. He would be by far the wealthiest president. He is the 59th wealthiest person in all of American history. And he wanted to protect that wealth, and that necessitated getting rid of the British as well as the Indians, and he proceeded to try to do both.
In a sense, this takes us back to your last book together, The Dictator's Handbook, because one of the major points was that you accumulate wealth for yourself and for friends who will support you in institutions.
Yeah, I'll turn to Alistair in a moment. But one of the motivations for writing Spoils of War to provide a complement to The Dictator's Handbook in a democratic setting, so that people would realize, although The Dictator's Handbook tries to make this point, that even in the most democratic societies and even in the biggest decisions, the decisions of war and peace, the same personal interests dominate decision making.
So, gentlemen, did you target some of the most popular presidents, or were you looking for periods in history? I mean, ultimately, how did you choose the lot that is contained in the book? Because it's not all of them.
Well, no, we focused on major wars, but we didn't really have to look particularly hard to. We didn't pick out, for example, the few that were the exception that were doing it for their own partisan political reasons or their own financial reasons. This was the norm rather than the exception. So we looked at major wars. We didn't study everything. We could have looked at the Mexican-American War, just literally for space constraints. We skipped other wars, but we could have told the same story about Polk.
So, Alistair, you write in the book, this is not an ideological critique, not partisan bias, or some mistaken sense of malice. So what does drive this?
Well, political leaders, people want to come to power, and they want to stay in power when they've got there. And at the end of the day, that's what it comes down to. And you sort of mentioned our earlier book, The Dictator's Handbook. The way to come to power is to cheat and steal. And, you know, in one of the, we talk a lot about this in the book. For example, we all tend to have this upright, stout, honest Abe for Abraham Lincoln. Yeah, you know, he was the same guy who fraudulently printed tickets to get his supporters admitted to the convention so that his rivals couldn't get in. He basically cheated his way into winning the nomination. This is what people do in the democratic system. They can't kill and imprison their political opponents, but they try, even within the constraints that they have, to always get the upper hand.
So Bruce, I'm trying to figure out if there are ever really altruistic looks at the reasons that people go to war. I mean, when I think about recent conflicts, for example, we intervened in Bosnia and Kosovo, but not in Syria. And four times as many people have died in Syria so far as died in the other two.
Well, unfortunately, altruism plays a very, very, very small part in politics, especially high politics. We do have a tragic hero in the spoils of war, and that's Lyndon Johnson. We could think of him as having been altruistic. Here's a man who has came to the White House by accident. President Kennedy was assassinated. And his first night in the White House, he said he had made a lot of mistakes in his life. He had been a segregationist and so forth, which was necessary to get elected in Texas. But now he was president. He was going to correct those mistakes and do what he believed was right. And he is the only example that we have in the book. Well, let me rephrase that. All the presidents thought they were doing what was right. He is the only one I think people would look back on and say, yes, indeed, he did do what was right. He tried to promote freedom, human rights, civil rights. The thing that ultimately did him in was the lottery in the Vietnam War rather than the draft system, the selective service system. He wanted everybody to be equally at risk. There was a lovely natural experiment which people studied. If you were a Northeastern Democrat who supported Lyndon Johnson and your son got a high-risk lottery number that is was likely to be drafted, you no longer supported Johnson. Not true if your son didn't get the high-risk number. And he understood that that was going to be the consequence. So if there's an altruist in the book, it would be Johnson, but you're really hard-pressed to find altruists who wind up being successful and reelected.
Well, and as Johnson pointed out when he signed civil rights legislation, he figured he was removing the Democratic Party from the South, or the South from the Democratic Party, for at least a generation to come. And he turned out to be right about that.
Yeah, for more than a generation.
Yeah, for the folks who don't remember, the draft lottery paired birth dates up with numbers. And if you got a lower number, you were more likely to get drafted. I remember this because my brother's draft number was a 324, so he didn't go to Vietnam. Much more to talk about with Bruce Bueno de Mesquita and Alistair Smith and their book, The Spoils of War. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. And entertain phone calls and emails from you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guests today are Bruce Bueno de Mesquita and Alistair Smith, professors of politics at New York University, joining hands for another book to follow up their earlier Dictator's Handbook. This one is about American presidents and war. It's called The Spoils of War: Greed, Power, and the Conflicts That Made Our Greatest Presidents. It suggests that they went to war for selfish reasons. And we talk about Washington, Madison, Lincoln, FDR, and there are some companion chapters with LBJ and W. Bush together and JFK and Obama together. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we explore their thesis. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Alistair, in the book you describe presidents as wielding two swords. What are they?
Well, they have to wield a sword of you deploying the U.S. Army overseas, and they also have to worry about their domestic constituents at home. We tend to think of high politics, international politics, as being above this partisan fray, but it never is. You can't continue to be president unless you continue to maintain domestic support. And when push comes to shove, presidents are more interested in staying in power. Mainly, they think they're doing the right thing. They want to promote the domestic agenda that they may think is right. But they can't do that unless they stay in power. And so the international sword that we think is for right and doing what is right for America is diverted to doing what's going to keep that political leader in power.
Well, so given the political pressure not to appear weak, is that war sword on a, not to mix metaphors here, but I'm going to, I guess, is it a, more of a hair trigger than the domestic sword?
There are times when we think that the U.S. should appear strong, and there are other times where we think that the use of force is completely unnecessary. And, you know, one of the examples we have in the book is we look at the War of 1812, which, you know, the average American thinks was a victory for the United States, which is almost certainly an error. They also think it was fought about issues of trade and impressment, and there's very little evidence that the war was fought for that. So the way to think about this is, who would the issues of impressment and trade have been beneficial to have settled with the British? It would have been the Federalist states in the northeast of the United States, New England. Those were the states that would have benefited from resolving those issues. And yet, they were the states that consistently voted against the war. They were very reluctant to fund it. They were very reluctant to provide military people to fight the war. So we have an instance here where the war hawks, the Republican Democrats in Congress, they promoted this issue to fulfill this idea that the English had done something wrong, which clearly the case, but that was not the issue. The real issue was they wanted to wipe out the Indians and expand the frontier into Canada, and they found ways of doing this. So I don't want to think about the U.S. having to appear strong. That was clearly a domestically generated attempt to promote war, to carry out the objectives that fulfilled a relatively small number of constituents.
In considering the division between domestic and foreign affairs, we just chime in for a moment.
Sure.
And note that most people don't realize, we didn't realize until we began this book, that presidents who preside over the death of lots of Americans in war are almost certain to be reelected. And presidents, in contrast, who preside over the promotion of peace and prosperity during their term in office, have a very low probability of being reelected. So the foreign sword is very appealing because they're politicians, and they don't get elected on foreign policy, but they get reelected on it.
Well, in fact, there's a chart in here of U.S. war dead and presidential ranking, Bruce. I mean, how did people turn up on that chart?
Well, so for example, Warren Harding ranks last among historians in terms of his stature as president. He presided over the death of zero Americans in war, and he presided over an 8% average annual increase in per capita income. On the other hand, at the other end of the scale, the presidents who do rank at the top, Abraham Lincoln presided over the death of 750,000 Americans in a war that, using statistical methods, we estimated should have lasted 6 months, not 4 years. Franklin Roosevelt ranks right below Lincoln, again, presided over a very large number of deaths, and so on. We go down the list of the presidents that we think were really great, and what they were really great at was presiding over the death of Americans in war.
Wow. Really compelling stuff here from Bruce Bueno de Mesquita and Alistair Smith in their book, The Spoils of War, about American presidents and the motivations to go to war. Nobody has really spelled this out, I would think, to this degree of plainness before you two. I mean, I can't imagine that any president ever took office thinking, well, I need to kill a few hundred thousand people to make sure I get reelected.
No, that's certainly not the message that we want to convey. It's not that they start out thinking that way. But what they do think is, take Lincoln, who we think of as the greatest president. I want to be president. I've got a problem. I'm not particularly popular. I've lost most of my elections in the past. The party doesn't particularly have that high a regard for me, and neither does the nation. How do I get people's attention? And so he delivers in Illinois, when he's running for the Senate in 1858, his very famous House Divided speech. Most of us know the famous lines, a house divided against itself cannot stand, but we don't read the details of the speech. But people at the time did. They listened to it. And it's a call for, as his competitor Stephen Douglas said, Mr. Lincoln is calling for the extermination of the South. Lincoln was standing in the audience when Douglas said that. He didn't deny it. He understood that he couldn't win without dividing the Democratic Party, and the way to divide it was over the slavery issue. He was genuinely anti-slavery, though he had done nothing about slavery in particular prior to the Dred Scott decision by the Supreme Court in 1857. Now in 1858, he starts to, and he realizes that, as he says in that speech, the nation will be all slave or all free. Now, the only way for it to be all free is constitutional amendment. And he realizes the only way to pass a constitutional amendment is to drive the South out of the Union, because they had too many votes to overturn or to create a new amendment. And he does drive them out. He creates a civil war. He refuses to negotiate in the months running up to the war, when there is a desperate effort by the Confederacy to try to cut a deal. He doesn't let them even just walk away, though he had advocated secession as a most sacred right on the floor of the House of Representatives in 1848. What he's looking at is, this is what's going to get me to the presidency, and it's also going to have this great moral consequence. I'm going to be able to amend the Constitution and get rid of slavery. But first is, I'm going to be president.
But when, so if he's thinking this far down the track, he's thinking that there are going to be states that will secede, and so we'll get the constitutional amendment passed when they're out of the Union. Was it that blatant, his thinking?
Oh, absolutely. He posed a question during those debates to Stephen Douglas that he knew was going to divide the Democratic Party in the presidential election. He was advised by his political handlers, so to speak, not to ask the question, because it would cost him the Senate seat. And he said, yes, but it will make me president. And what that question did was ask Douglas, would he support, could any territory pass a law against the Constitution? And if Douglas said yes, then he was taking the anti-slavery position, which was popular in Illinois, and he would win and not Lincoln. And if he said no, then Lincoln would win the Senate. So Douglas would be weakened either way. But Douglas said yes, and that meant that in 1860, the Democratic Party didn't unite behind him. So there were three people out of the Democratic Party who ran for president: Douglas, John Breckinridge, who was the sitting vice president of the United States under James Buchanan, and Senator Bell. So Lincoln wins the presidency with less than 40% of the popular vote, and he planned it. Absolutely, it was planned. It was intentional. He knew exactly what he was doing. It was the only way he could get to be president.
We are talking to Bruce Buena de Mesquita and Alistair Smith from New York University about their book, The Spoils of War, Greed, Power, and the Conflicts That Made Our Greatest Presidents. The basic thesis, they went to war for selfish reasons. 800-838-3760 if you have thoughts about this view of history. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back, and we've been hopping around a bit in time. I want to come back to Washington for just a bit, because we are talking about him not going to war as president. We already established that he was a very, very wealthy man. In fact, the 59th wealthiest person in the country, you've said, in
American
all time.
History.
Yeah, in all time.
Yes, in all time. He's second wealthiest in his day.
So what, how did the moves of the British king threaten Washington's empire?
Alistair, you're a Brit. You want to talk about that? Or you
want well, basically, the king had different agenda to those of the American colonists. So the British king thought that he had right to protect the Native Americans, and so basically he passed a proclamation in 1763 that basically said lands up in the Ohio Valley cannot be owned by the people of the 13 colonies. These are sort of Indian lands, or if they are going to be developed, they're going to be developed by additional English colonies rather than existing English colonies. And effectively, enormously wealthy people in the colonies had actually made huge land investments. And then suddenly they were going to be made penniless, because all the money they pumped in was suddenly going to be worthless. So what do they want to go around doing? They want to antagonize, we've had the war with the French Indian Wars to clear out this land, clear out the French, clear out a lot of the Indian tribes. The king is standing in the way. What's the way to get around the king? We have to find grounds on which we can complain. So if you read the Declaration of Independence, it starts with that beautiful statement that we all know. But if you actually read the grievances, a lot of the grievances are about expanding the frontier and capturing these lands. We remember the taxation, but you know, there are many other things about expanding the land.
How connected politically, though, was George Washington at the outbreak of war and the lead-up to it? Because he was not a signer to the Declaration of Independence, certainly. He was out in the field fighting the war, but I'm just curious to know how he managed to get his wishes known to enough people who could push for this.
Well, we focus on Washington as, of course, the first president, but he's not alone in his point of view. Almost all of the founding fathers are in the same camp. They're very wealthy people. John Hancock, 53rd wealthiest man in American history.
Wow.
Benjamin Franklin, the 80-some-odd wealthiest person in American history. Even, you know, poor old Thomas Jefferson is the third wealthiest president we had. His net worth at death was $116 million in today's terms. The Adamses were equal to the Bushes in net worth. Washington is just the exemplar. All of these guys, he didn't have to make it known. They all understood the king was threatening their wealth. Indeed, it's interesting to realize that 60% of the colonists either were neutral or opposed to the revolution. Only 40% supported the revolution. And when we think of revolutionaries, we don't think of the richest people in the country, but that's who the revolutionaries were in the American Revolution. These were guys whose great wealth was being threatened. Why did Washington and Jefferson have antagonism between them? Well, Jefferson's father, Peter Jefferson, owned a land speculation company in the Ohio Valley in direct competition with George Washington's brother, Lawrence Washington, who owned a company with two others called the Ohio Valley Company. They were all out to secure wealth. And now, by the king's proclamation and then by the Stamp Act and a bunch of other acts, the king was saying to them, I'm not going to let you be rich. I'm going to let English colonists and what the Declaration refers to, I quote, the Indian savages become successful.
So each of these chapters ends with a what if segment and takes a look at what possible alternatives might have been. So if Washington had thought there was another way to accomplish things other than separation from England, what would that other way have been?
Well, they could have asked the British. The alleged complaint was taxation without representation. They could have asked the British for proportional representation in Parliament. The Americans represented about 25% of the population of what one might have thought of at the time as British citizens. If they had 25% representation in Parliament, the king could have taxed them without all of this grief, and they would have been a big enough faction that they could have formed coalitions and helped to shape policy. But they didn't pursue that.
Bruce Blaina de Mesquita and Alistair Smith are guests on the Jefferson Exchange, professors of politics at New York University. Their book together is called The Spoils of War, Greed, Power, and the Conflicts That Made Our Greatest Presidents. A couple of emails here. Wolfgang in Sunny Valley writes, is there any war that had really altruistic motives? Isn't it always about gaining or not losing access to natural resources or military or political power? Are not presidents always beholden to the people who finance their ascent to power? What are motives that could possibly make a war not selfish, asks Wolfgang. Alice, do you want to take that?
Well, I got to say, Wolfgang is a fellow traveler. Well, I couldn't agree with him more. That's exactly the point. Politicians, if they want to be successful, they have to take care of those key supporters that got them into power and keep them in power. And that's the number one thing that a successful political leader does. And Bruce alluded to it earlier. If you don't do that, and we point to the example in the book of a leader for whom the war goes wrong, that's LBJ, he started taxing his middle-class supporters. He started sending their children off through the draft lottery to Vietnam. Your supporters will turn on them and you'll be out of power. And that's exactly what happened to him. So I couldn't agree more.
Let's take a call from Archie in Talent because he brings up LBJ as well. Archie, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I was in Vietnam, and when I was there, President Johnson gave a speech over Armed Forces Television where he said that we were not in Cambodia and we weren't going to Cambodia and all of that. And I had just gotten back from there, rescuing a helicopter, so I really decided this man is not to be trusted. Okay, and besides that, his wife, Lady Bird Johnson, owned a good share of International Harvester, and that's all we saw being driven around by the economy, the electric people and the gas line people and the water people. They're all driving International Harvester trucks. And so I think they made a lot of money off of that war, and I still don't see any more reason for even having the war. Could you comment on that? Thank you.
Thank you, Archie.
Well, let me just note that Lyndon Johnson was a very wealthy man, so I don't think that, I don't know whether he made money on the war, but the marginal improvement in his economic situation would not have been great. He was already a very wealthy man. So I don't think that was the motivation. I didn't know that Lady Bird was a significant owner of International Harvester. But to be fair, they made very good products, so it might have been that she owned it because they were good products and they were used because they were good products. I just don't know. I don't think that most of the presidents engaged in war, particularly after George Washington, were in it primarily for money. I think they were in it primarily for political advantage. Wars get people reelected, they're seen as heroic and so forth. And so I suspect that that was more the motivation than money, though one can point to lots of idiosyncratic examples, and it's hard to be sure.
Mike in Medford writes, it sounds like history just repeats itself. Americans have never had enough education to vote. This election is certainly reminding us that. Well, it was going to get in here at some point. Do you guys care to compare what's going on now in this election with claims made that got people in this book elected?
Well, I'd like to take that question and push it a little bit further and think about how can we, as the citizens of the United States, prevent these leaders pursuing adventurous foreign policies for their own gain. How do we constrain militarism and get wars to be fought only when they're in their the interests of what we might think of as we the people? And that's the sort of approach that we take in our concluding chapter. We think, how can we stop political leaders fighting wars, and we want to hold them to account through information.
We'll have to pick it up on the other side of a break. Back with Alistair Smith and Bruce Buena de Mesquita and the spoils of war in 1 minute here on The Exchange. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guests today are both professors of politics at NYU, New York University. Bruce Buena de Mesquita and Alistair Smith joined us several years ago to talk about The Dictator's Handbook. And their latest book together is a bit of a follow-up to that, but it looks at our system instead of dictatorships. It is called The Spoils of War, Greed, Power, and the Conflicts That Made Our Greatest Presidents. The thesis being that presidents go to war for selfish reasons, because they get reelected or because they get financial gain, or both, or other things as well. Join us on The Exchange with your perspective on this, 800-838-3760. And email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Alistair, you were talking before the break about trying to get to a system where we can stop presidents for going to war for selfish reasons. The Constitution is essentially set up to make sure that Congress has the power to declare war. What has happened?
Yeah, but that's the practical reality is that the congressional power to declare war is not being particularly important. In the War of 1812, we look at how easily Congress went along with voting on that to go to war. We want to think in the book about sensible reasons how we can hold political leaders to account. So, for example, we mentioned earlier in the conversation, we're talking about statistically, if we look at the Civil War, it should have taken about 6 months for Lincoln to win. Just the enormous advantages the North had in terms of men and armaments in industry. It's 108 miles from D.C. to Richmond. It took 4 years to get 108 miles. We think that's a particularly poor performance. We think had it been expressed as if people had known that this war should take 6 months, people would have had a much dimmer opinion of Lincoln when they were thinking about the election coming up. Otherwise, we think they're very important in holding leaders to account, is that when leaders are contemplating wars, we should have an impartial assessment of what the likely costs are going to be. So consistently, we found this a feature across all of the conflicts we study, is that people give estimates that are a tiny fraction of what the actual real costs come to be, whether this is 1812, whether this is the Iraq War. It's a small, a tenth of the cost. People who provide even very conservative estimates, they're actually ostracized by the administration and driven out of office. And so we think that a way to constrain presidents is to have an impartial sort of a congressional accounting office type basis where we can think of, congressional budget office type procedure where conflicts are being contemplated, we can have serious estimates of how long this should take, how many people will get killed, and how much is it likely to cost. Then we can decide in an unbiased, nonpartisan way whether this is a war worth fighting. And more importantly, we can see how well did the president do relative to the expected goals. Did they do it under budget? Did they do it with fewer lives? And did they do it quicker? That's a president that I would like to elect.
Although it seems like war always comes with a great deal more emotion attached to it than the cold accounting you're talking about here.
That's exactly the problem, is that because it's such an emotive issue and people are seen as being unpatriotic if they don't get behind the war effort, is that we rush to arms and we allow the president to define what success is. And that we end up with, 750,000 people being killed in the Civil War that took, arguably 9 times longer than we expect it should have taken.
Suppose that we, before the heat of the moment, we had panels, independent panels, that were assessing these costs for things that might escalate to war. So, for example, what would it cost in lives, dollars, and time if the United States became engaged in protecting the Philippines over Scarborough Shoal in the South China Sea, or Japan's island Senkaku against the Chinese, or what would it cost if the United States under, say, a President Clinton decided to, at this point, intervene against the Assad government in Syria. If those things were done well in advance, and they can be done well in advance, they don't have to be in the emotional heat of the moment, then the president will know, and his opposition or her opposition will know, these are the likely costs. If the opposition thinks it's too costly, they're going to make a firm case. This does not make sense. If they think it's not, then their electoral prospects are improved by keeping their mouths shut. And so the American people will get a very strong signal that we're going down a bad path or not. We don't do that now. We only trust partisans to tell us what these things are going to cost. And, of course, they have no incentive to tell us the truth.
But if you're counting the time it will take and the number of people who will die and the number of dollars, you're still, it seems, not accounting for projection of power. And if we give up on these islands in the South China Sea, we'll never be operative in that region again. You're casting forward into something that really doesn't seem to have dollars attached to it, aren't you?
Well, so our view is, go ahead, Alistair.
The key here, though, is you've just expressed something that may be a valuable piece of policy, but you have to think about, is that a price that you're willing to pay to have that policy influence? And we can disagree about whether a conflict with China would be worthwhile or not. But the key is we should think about what that conflict will actually cost so we can make an informed decision and we can hold our political leaders to account with respect to that informed decision.
Back to
the politician's job is to persuade us that the fight is worth it. And when we say worth it, the it is the part that we want to address. The it is the costs. Their job is to make the argument for the benefits.
Bruce, coming back to the Lincoln example, the last president we talked about here, does he get any slack for recognition that it was going to take longer to get the country as a whole to come around to the question of banning slavery? Does he get some slack there for thinking in those terms, or do you think it was all just about, well, I got to make this last through the 64 election?
Well, we do grant him some slack. We're not willing to say that he did or did not make a mistake. But again, if these panels that we're talking about existed, one of the things that would have been estimated is, well, how long do we think that slavery can persist? Two things we're pushing strongly against slavery surviving for long. Irish immigrants were flooding into the country, and their labor was actually cheaper than slave labor. There's a wonderful study about 30 years ago by Fogelin and Engerman, Time on the Cross, that demonstrates that. And most of the world, Europe, Asia, Latin America, had all made slavery illegal. So there was tremendous political pressure as well to get rid of it. So the question has to be asked, we lost 750,000 people, all in their most productive years. Obviously, if you were a slave, this was a good thing. If you were not, then you had to ask the question, what was the devastation to the economy and to families? Against how long would it have taken to to be rid of slavery. And nobody did that analysis. We propose that that should always be done.
And to come back to this particular time in history, it's not just these presidents. We get to get into the statements and motivations of other characters as well, including Jefferson Davis, who was the president of the Confederacy. He himself is shown as having great doubts about secession. So who pushed it so hard?
Well, a group called the Fire Eaters, who were lower-level Southern politicians who saw in Civil War an opportunity for them to become more important people in the smaller Confederate government. They were instrumental, especially in South Carolina. Jefferson Davis, who had been Franklin Pierce's Minister of War, understood the South was going to lose. He was very reluctant to see a war. He was reluctant to accept the presidency for that reason. But these Fire Eaters just pushed the South, and the South was deeply divided. People don't realize the votes on secession were close votes, and in many states had to be voted on more than once before they voted in favor of secession. So there was an opportunity in there for President Lincoln, or President-elect Lincoln at the moment, to have stepped up to the plate and done the right thing to help prevent the war while advancing his agenda. And it's possible that, and Jeff Davis tried to do that. Lincoln refused to meet with his commission. The South made very big mistakes, and the North made very big mistakes.
So what's the what-if for Lincoln? I mean, we have a what-if in every chapter here. And so what could Lincoln have done differently?
He could have let the South secede. The South didn't grow food. It grew cash crops. It was, at the start of the war, not producing munitions either. Had the North boycotted the South, so had an embargo against its goods, there's a good chance that individual states in the South would have gradually and fairly quickly broken away from the Confederacy and sought to come back into the Union, and they could only do that on terms that Lincoln would have found acceptable, as was the case when they eventually did come back. So letting them go might have been the best solution. He could then have amended the Constitution, not have had 750,000 dead, and probably have crushed their economies peacefully so that they would come back and do it the way he wanted it done.
So we skip a long way. I mean, you go from Lincoln to FDR, so we jump about 80 years here. The general view, accepted, I think, up to this point, is that FDR was dealing with an isolationist country and couldn't have gone to war any sooner than he did without the attack. Are you guys coming at this from a different approach there as well?
Alistair, you want to do that?
No, go. Keep going, Bruce. You're on a roll.
So FDR came into office with economic disaster, and he led public opinion. He created policies that had never been contemplated by the American people before. He moved the country from a laissez-faire economy to a large central government economics. That had never existed before. They listened because he said, we have to experiment. If the experiment doesn't work, we'll try something else. He was a leader. So we see it as there were two FDRs. There was the leader FDR from 1933 to 39, and then there was the follower FDR, who looked at the polls, and though he wanted to get into the war and defend democracy in Europe, he wouldn't do it because it was unpopular, as opposed to his having educated the population to its importance. He never made the effort. And we believe that had the United States come into the war in 39, millions of lives would have been saved. Adolf Hitler believed that, by the way, as well. Adolf Hitler did not believe that he could win a war if the United States was in it. But Roosevelt followed the public opinion.
So then the seeking of a third term, which Roosevelt gets credit for, he got elected the third time and a fourth time, in fact. But as you point out in the book, not the only president to at least think out loud about the prospect of a third term.
Contrary to the belief that there's a two-term norm, the first president after Andrew Jackson to be alive at the end of a second term was Ulysses S. Grant, and Grant sought a third term nomination. He was the front runner in the Republican Party through many ballots, and then he lost. The next president to be alive at the end of two terms was Grover Cleveland, a Democrat. He, too, was the front runner in his party. He, too, sought a third term nomination, and he failed to get the party nomination. The next president to have the opportunity was Theodore Roosevelt, and he ran as a bull moose to try to get another term. We could go on. But the point is that it's a myth that there was this norm. And if we go to the early presidents who had two terms and didn't seek a third, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, and Andrew Jackson, two things are true of each of them. Madison, Monroe, and Jefferson were all in their mid to late 60s at the end of their second term. That was very old at the time. Andrew Jackson was 70 and also very sickly at the time. And each of them hand-picked his successor so that the policies they wanted continued because they picked the guy who would succeed. Once that was no longer feasible, every president who had the opportunity for to go after a third term did. They just weren't successful until Franklin Roosevelt.
Final question here from Jeff in Ashland. He says, in the case of modern wars, are the decisions in part decided or at least directed by the Pentagon and corporations like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin? Alistair, you want to take that?
Well, I think the answer to that is no, extent to politicians have considerable extent as to when they go into war. They need weapons to fight wars, and they're beholden to defense contractors to get them there. These are, we're beholden to these industries in the sense that they provide a lot of campaign finance and support and lobbying support for presidents, but no more than any other lobbying group in particular.
Well, anytime you guys write a book, I want to make sure you're on the exchange because it is always a fascinating journey. This one is called The Spoils of War. It follows the earlier book, The Dictator's Handbook. Bruce Bueno de Mesquita and Alistair Smith are both professors of politics at New York University. Thank you both again for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Take care.